Build a better business, be a better architect. A profitable business will give you the funding, the flexibility, and the freedom to become that architect you want to be. And we can help. Download our free course, Profit for Small Firm Architects, at entrearchitect.com/freecourse. You are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 194. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. I am often asked by students or young architects with an idea that might change the world in some big or small way, how they might start a charity, a nonprofit organization that serves their community or serves the world at large. What's the first step? How do you obtain funding to launch and plant that seed of an idea and have it sprout into full blossom? And once you get it successfully started serving the needs of others, how do you keep it growing into an organization that might bear fruit for generations to come? This week, we dive into answering some of those questions in this episode at Entree Architect Podcast, Launching and Growing an Architecture Charity with Azuco.org. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, Core by BQE Software, RCAT, and Charette Venture Group. And I'm going to share a little bit more about these great companies and organizations later in the show. But as we get started here, just take a quick note right now, just note it down to go share some time this week to go visit each one of them and let them know that you appreciate them supporting us here at the Entree Architect community. Joe Ashbridge and Nathan Ardaiz, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark. Thanks.
It's great to have you both here. Let me just tell our listeners who you are and what you do. Azuco, you are both from Azuco. Azuco, A-Z-U-K-O, is an architecture charity. They work alongside disadvantaged communities to create culturally sensitive design solutions, from housing, sanitation, and infrastructure to play and public space. Their projects address the real needs of communities they work with. Through extensive research, Azuco provides insight into current living conditions, offers a vision for the future, and supports local communities to better their own environments. Their work is currently based in the UK, Bangladesh, and China. And Joe Ashbridge is the director of Azuco, and Nathan Ardaiz is the design researcher. And so we have them here. I'm excited about this conversation. But before we get into any sort of depth of what Azuco is and how they serve the world, I'd love to sort of go back to your stories individually and hear about who you are, where you came from, and sort of what brought you to where you are today. So, Joe, why don't you start with your origin story, go back to what inspired you to follow the path that you have and give us that journey to where you find yourself today, and then we'll go on to Nathan.
Sure. How far to go back, really?
As far back as you feel comfortable going back. What inspired you to architecture?
Yeah, I'd say it was my father, if we can go before architecture school.
Yeah.
He's a welder in the north of England, and he's a real maker. And we were always making things together, building small models of ships, building stuff for the garden. And we had, a real synergy there. And I think after school, I wanted to go into making, but didn't know exactly what that would be or what vocation that was. I can't quite remember how it happened, but I ended up in architecture school, not having any architects or engineers in the family. So I was a little bit, I felt a little bit out of my depth in the beginning, although I knew I wanted to make things with my hands, and I had a sort of, I had a sort of design thinking approach to things. So yeah, that's how I ended up in architecture school in Bath University, which led on to Cambridge University. And in some ways, well, it was amazing for many reasons. I loved being part of studio in that environment, but in some ways I felt a little bit out of place. I wasn't necessarily working on projects that I was super passionate about. And in my summer, I ended up going to volunteer in Vietnam. My dad had come back. We had come back for summer, actually, and my dad had come back from one of his trips abroad. And I was doing some sketching on a drawing board, and he said, "You know, do you know how that roof's actually made? I mean, it's a nice drawing, but do you know how it's put together?" And of course, I didn't. I've never worked on a construction site before. And he said, "Before you go any further, before you go back to your fourth year, you need to go and work in construction to understand the craftsmanship." And I guess I think he thought I was going to stay in the UK. I booked a plane and I ended up in Vietnam. And a little
that backfired on him
a little bit. History. Yeah. And it spiraled out of control. I kept going further and further.
Love you, Dad.
See you. Come with me. No, thanks. yeah, and a little bit the rest is history. I sort of found myself in the world of international development, particularly in the shelter sector, and I felt really comfortable there. I felt free. I felt I was working on things that were meaningful to me, that could have great impact. I could use my skills for the good of people that rarely have access to it. And I traveled that path for a little further, working for various nonprofits in various countries, on various projects, and then Azuqua sort of formed out of that. My learnings from working with those nonprofits, a passion for grassroots development, as well as a little bit of serendipity, meeting the right people and having the right conversations, and people wanting to help us set up.
Talk a little bit, Joe, about what Azuqua is and what it does, sort of as at a base level.
Yeah, so we are an architecture charity. Sometimes people struggle a little when we define ourselves as that. Usually the terms architecture and charity don't go well together. So we're a nonprofit that supports people to improve their living conditions. So we work in the realm of the built environment, and we work on real community needs. So we like to think we're designers that continue to sit around the table with you, irrespective of what the end product might be. So although we call ourselves an architecture charity, we don't always result in a built solution, but we essentially work with communities to support them to improve their living conditions. And we work with a section of society that rarely has access or can afford architectural services.
Awesome. I want to get into how you started and how you get funded and how, you know, because that's the conversation that I'd love to have, because I get that question a lot here at Entree Architect. You know, I have this dream of changing the world and I want to do this as a nonprofit. How do I go about doing that? So before we get into that, I want to hear Nathan's story, and then I want to talk about how Azuqua, you know, how what was the seed of Azuqua and how did you get it started and launched off the ground? So Nathan, tell us your story about, you know, how you got started.
Thanks. Thanks for having us, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. I love these kind of discussions of causation. How do people end up how they are? I think I grew up in a very warm, familial environment. I grew up in my mom had seven siblings, and I had 20 cousins, and I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I recall a lot of warmth and a lot of openness, and it was a very kind of hospitable environment. And I think from a young age was taught a lot about empathy and about other people's experience and about openness and I grew up in the Silicon Valley, well, what is now the Silicon Valley, and also a very diverse place. And so I think from a young age, I felt like I was going to be working with people or working not necessarily just for money. And I think eventually was introduced to a lot of different interests and types of work, everything from education and pedagogy and working with young people and mentorship, particularly with socially disadvantaged groups. Worked with a charity in San Francisco for some time. It was a mentoring program there. I also have a bit of a background in education in sustainability, and sustainability kind of in its greater definition. And during that time, when I was in my master's program, I think I was probably much more interested in social psychology, behavioral economics, behavioral psychology, the design process, how people behave, and the research that goes into that, and how you start to form designs, or where designs come from. And that led me to leading groups and training and facilitation, doing bits of communication as well, and writing for a magazine, and then eventually just wanted to focus on serving people, really. And and again, I think that kind of just comes from this experience in an immigrant household, and one that was very warm and just served people, constantly served people. And so the Zuko has been a really kind of serendipitous mixture of all those things that I've been working on and interested in. And yeah, at some point I think I had found some real interest in urban design, and there's some really wonderful examples in London that I had come across as well, kind of mixed use spaces, some stuff that Ben Hamilton Bailey does in particular, and an interest in anti-fragility, and how you can imagine spaces or imagine cities for people, for them to thrive. And I think the opportunity to work in space or in the built environment, I think, was always interesting for me. And again, Azuko was kind of a really lovely melding of all those things.
And how did you get hooked up with the Zuko? I mean, how did you make, because you
Twitter.
You were in the U.S. and the Zuko is in, I didn't mention this, and but it may be obvious by this point, but the Zuko is in the U.K. And so how did that happen? So was it a Twitter connection?
Yeah, well, I'd actually come to London to do a fellowship here in social entrepreneurship. And I was thinking about kind of doing my own thing, but yeah, I actually just came across Azuko on Twitter, and like I said, this bit of work was kind of forming over 3 years. I think whatever this role was, I didn't know about it beforehand, but it was like I said, it was something that I just kind of been slowly working towards, and this it just happened to be a really wonderful mix of all those things.
And then, so you were in London, right? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, the fellowship was in London. Yeah, yeah. I lived in San Francisco for 3 years before that, and it was doing, like I said, a collection of all those things here and there.
And then, so you just met up and connected and talked about what Azuko does, and felt that it was a good place for you to be. How did that connection happen?
Yeah, so I saw the opportunity to work with Azuko, and actually, I had written it in my letter to Joe. But I had this really serendipitous exchange with a man at a cafe that I frequented in East London, and we just had a really intimate discussion about understanding people's experiences, and how oftentimes you don't know what people are going through. And he talked about forgiveness, and he talked about a process by which you go about changing things and changing yourself. And actually the guy was an alcoholic, and he just told me about his process of recovery and what it meant to him. And I basically just explained that conversation in my letter to Joe, and it just felt like, like I said, not necessarily always understanding people's experiences, but being open to listen and to empathize with them as being the kind of basis for quality design, and also not bringing your own biases and not bringing your own assumptions about people, because it's easy to judge someone who says that they're an alcoholic, and it's it's a bit more descriptive than that, but an apt conversation that I had that led to this discussion with Joe.
Yeah, it sounds like your path was leading to Azuko, and you just needed to keep following that path, and your friend was a guide along your path and said, keep going.
It was amazing.
I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, we were reaching out to bring someone else on. When I say we, I was the only full-time member of staff, but of course we have a board of trustees and volunteers and supporters that help us in different ways. But we were looking for another full-time member of staff to join, and we had a specific project in mind. And when this sort of cover letter or introduction to another human came in, it felt like it was different for a start, which took our attention, but it also felt like a really great fit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. It sounds like you were meant for one another. So that's it's good.
I tell her that every day.
Well, I just helped you reinforce that. Let's talk a little bit about Azuko itself. Let's start with the name, because it's a very interesting name and you have some capital letters in there. So can you explain what Azuko is and you know why that name?
Yeah, it means all of humanity. In an endangered language in central northern Congo, and it's an endangered language because it's not a written language. Mm-hmm. So, like many tribal or vulnerable languages, it will likely disappear eventually, and with it, understanding of culture. But it's also quite an inclusive term that we think, summed up what we were trying to do, getting everyone around the table and achieving this design democracy. So we sort of pushed the words together. So if you understand the intonation, it almost feels like two separate words. So we pushed the two words together, but kept the capital K to reflect that true intonation of how it is spoken in the DRC.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect: FreshBooks, Core by BQE Software, Arcat, and Charette Venture Group. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. My absolute favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I love this. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of those barriers to our success as entrepreneur architects. Who has time, right? But if we don't get out the invoices, then we don't get paid, right? Well, FreshBooks makes it easy to send out your invoices and get paid online with a click of a button. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, FreshBooks will send them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks to access FreshBooks for free, and be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. One of the most often requested resources here at the Entree Architect community is project management software. How do we keep our projects and all our people organized while we grow as entrepreneur architects? BQE Core revolutionizes the way architects manage projects, time and expenses, billing and accounting. Made by BQE, the company behind ArchiOffice, Core saves you time while giving you the visibility, flexibility, and the power you need to grow your firm. Work from anywhere, seamlessly collaborate, and gain transformative insights with Core's groundbreaking platform. Listeners here at the Entree Architect podcast can get a free 15-day trial of CORE at entrearchitect.com/BQE. If you've been listening to this podcast anytime during the past few months, you've heard me talking about my friends RCAT, and hopefully you've been using their free resources on a regular basis. But for those of you who have not yet checked them out, go check them out. RCAT is a great tool for us small firm architects. RCAT has a huge library of free content, CAD, BIM, specifications, and more. And they've done all the work for you. If you need a spec, click on over, download the CSI three-part specification in multiple file formats. You need a CAD file or BIM object, it's all free. Just click the mouse. RCAT has tons of building product content ready for you to use, and it's all completely free. You don't even have to register to download the content. Visit our friends over at RCAT at entrearchitect.com/RCAT. That's A-R-C-A-T. entrearchitect.com/RCAT. And let them know that we sent you right here from the Entree Architect podcast. Charette Venture Group invests in small to mid-size architecture firms. Listen up, that's you. Their goal is to create action behind your aspirations. CVG seeks architect clients with a passion for growth and a dedication to becoming a stronger business. Entree Architect is an investment partner with CVG, so I know firsthand how their support has transformed my business and my life. We also have several members inside the Entree Architect Academy who are also investment partners with CVG, and it is truly a pleasure to watch these firms grow and thrive. The team over at Charette Venture Group is ready to help take your architecture firm to the next level. Your firm is unique, but your challenges aren't. Charette Venture Group can help. To schedule a free consultation with Charette Venture Group or to take their free architect business assessment to see exactly where you stand as a business, visit them today at entrearchitect.com/CVG. FreshBooks, BQE Software, RCAT, and Charette Venture Group. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So let's talk about how you got started. How, you know, so Joe, you had this, you were traveling, working with a lot of other nonprofits and serving the communities. And then Azuqo came along. And so how did that, what was the seed, first of all, mm-hmm. of Azuqo? And how did you make that seed sort of grow into a real organization?
Difficult one. At the time I was working and living in Bangladesh, supporting a local shelter nonprofit there who we continue to work with now. And we were sort of researching earth and architecture and the successes, but also the challenges of this material in Bangladesh and in South Asia. And we had sort of a pot of funding for a year to undertake this research. And we were coming towards the end of the research project, but we felt we had so much more to do. One aspiration was that we wanted to really test out our ideas and our learnings. So I came back to the UK and spoke to a few people about it. And we ended up having a really wonderful a cup of tea with the traditional architecture practice called RIDA. I knew them from back in the day. I'm a Geordie. I'm from Newcastle, the north of England, and their headquarters is in Newcastle. And they said, you know, we're interested. We're interested. We don't know what this will be yet. Can we come along with you? And we sort of said yes. We didn't know what it would be at the start. So those conversations led to more conversations, led to talking to other people about what potential business models that would be. And we ended up believing that what we wanted to be was a charity, so that we could really focus our efforts on supporting those that typically can't afford design services. They helped us. They helped sort of to fund us for a while until we can set up. And now they're our patron.
So go ahead.
Carry on. Just to say, if you're interested in charitable structures, we're set up as a charitable incorporated organization, a CIO, which is a structure in the UK, similar to a company limited by guarantee, but for charities. So gives you a lot of freedom in many ways, but also has a lot of reporting that comes along with it.
So Ryder gave you some financial support to get started, some sort of, you know, resources. And that was a relationship, a previous relationship that you had with them. So you went to them and said, hey, I have this idea. Where are you interested in sort of helping us get this off the ground? Was that the conversation you had?
A little. I mean, we knew each other because when I was younger, going through architecture school, I had a 3-month placement, mm-hmm. and they're quite an important architecture firm in the northeast of England. They're very well known. And so we knew each other from those days. We ended up having a cup of tea talking about many things. I didn't go into it with a pitch.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting to set up an organization. Maybe further down my career, that would have been an intention, but it certainly wasn't something I had planned for.
So you're talking about life.
I'm talking about taking opportunity yeah. when it was presented.
Yeah.
Yeah, and running with it. I had a bit of freedom at that time. In terms of life, I was between projects potentially. I didn't have a mortgage. I just had my backpack, so I could ride the wave a little bit.
Yeah, it's because that's always the hardest part, right? Is getting started, whether it's a nonprofit or somebody launching their own architecture firm. You know, that first step of going from an idea or a dream to actually making it reality. And I think that first step is actually committing to it and say, okay, I'm going to do this. Now I have to figure out how to do it.
Yes.
Well, I think the interesting thing too about that story is that Joe, you'd already been working in that community for some time, which eventually became the foundation for Zuko anyways, right?
Yeah, correct. I'd been living in a village and a district in Bangladesh on and off for 2.5 years. And worked different parts of the country as well. So I felt like I was embedded there. I worked for our partner, for a local shelter organization for over a year. So it was a real natural fit. One of the things we really champion is that we work in and through local organizations, trusted organizations within communities. So this sort of connection already made a lot of sense. We didn't have a name. We didn't have our chargeable structure, but we had projects already on the table.
Okay, can you give us like a concrete example of one project that you have done, just so we can kind of get a sense of the type of work that Azuko is doing.
Do you want a completed bit of work?
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just sort of so we can get a real life example of what you're doing, whether it's something that's in the works now or something that's completed and you see some results.
Sure. We have been working with and continue to work with a community of about 250 people in an urban informal settlement in the northwest of Bangladesh, a community in an area called Jogan Babu Mart. And the idea is that we're supporting the community with incremental slum upgrading works over a long period of time. We work in the sort of world of development rather than aid. So we sort of invest our time and commit to a long-term process. And we've been working, I've been working with the community before Azuko started, but we continue to work with the community as Azuko on a number of projects, double-story bamboo houses, the first sort of double story structures in that community, greening initiatives to green public space. We've recently just finished a communal sanitation facility. But one of the interesting things about this project is not necessarily the built solutions, which do in themselves improve living conditions and well-being, but also that we try to support communities in terms of capacity building, offering training throughout that project process, understanding of the design, empowerment. So we help to facilitate a democratic election to form a new committee, and those individuals represent the community throughout the design process. They then are supported to site manage to construct the buildings themselves. And in this way, that when we step away from the project, when things break, when there are maintenance needs, because no building is maintenance free, the community themselves can go to market, buy the right products, barter for the right cost, complete the remedial works themselves. And hopefully the overall aim is that, you know, we put ourselves out of a job and they continue to develop without us, really, because they have the skills to do so.
Yeah, and that's so important, right? To go in there, not just fix their problems and then walk away and then they end up with a bigger problem than they started with.
Correct. I mean, we've just finished a communal sanitation facility, but we're inhabiting an existing building that used to be a communal sanitation facility 15, 16 years ago. This area that they live on was reclaimed land, and nonprofits, wonderful nonprofits, supported them to sort of build basic infrastructure. But our understanding of that was they were sort of, these buildings were flown in, quite basic buildings, quite simple buildings, but they were flown in, erected very quickly by outside contractors, and over a period of time things broke and those facilities were then out of use. So when we started working with Jong Babu Ma, we had this building in our sights, we knew we should bring it back to life, and it had a real a use to it, but what we didn't want to replicate was that as an outside organization, as a non-Bangladeshi organization, we would just fix that building, because we could foresee that would happen again later down the line. So we wanted to work with the community so they were able to repair it and manage it as a group.
And how do you actually pick the project? Because it sounds like these communities would have many, many projects. So how is the decision made on which projects you're going to focus on?
Yeah, well, it all starts with the community, really. But in this case, we'd already been working with the community for some time. So the next phase, we always start with a needs assessment. So we gather baseline data. We bring together a group. We discuss those needs. As a group, we then try and create a hierarchy of what's needed. And our overall goal is to support communal, in this sense, communal infrastructure, rather than supporting one or two family members who are most at need. So it's sort of what can we do that will be most impactful for the many in this scenario. And so it's not really us who comes up with the brief. We are just there to facilitate the creation of that brief. Mm-hmm. It's the community themselves that drive that vision.
So they're deciding on which projects to focus on.
Correct. I mean, that's one of the... One of the things that is great about Azuco is that we're flexible in that way. We're not an organization that only focuses on sanitation, water and hygiene, for example. So that allows us to tap into the real needs of a community, if they touch on improving living conditions.
Yeah, I love the holistic approach that you're taking, that it's not just architecture or construction, but you're actually going in and looking at the entire problem and talking about training and construction and design and whatever else needs to happen. It's all being taken into account, which lets us leverage our skills as architects, right? I mean, as designers and architects, we can take those ideas and do more with them than just design a building and build it and move on to the next step.
Yeah, actually, we were speaking to one of the colleagues in our office today. We work in a shared space, and he was saying that a lot of younger architects that he knows are coming out of architecture school and feeling quite disengaged with the design process. Well, A, because it takes such a long time for buildings to get built, and also just kind of general disconnect from the user. So he said people are going into user experience and user interface design, which is interesting, because that's ultimately just thinking about, there's an architectural of the kind of digital experience, but maybe has nothing to do necessarily with what they're doing in a building, but actually how are they being talked to, who are they talking to, who are they connecting with, what's important to them, what kind of words do they associate with a quality or a meaningful experience, which again, like you're saying, Mark's not the architects have the skills to be able to do that thing, those things, and have the experience and the training. It's just a matter of kind of opening up the question about what is this experience we're trying to design for people.
Yeah. I think that's so important for all architects to consider that it's not just about buildings. It's the problem solving skills that we've been trained to have. We can leverage that in so many different ways and affect so many more people and possibly even create a life for yourself that's much more enjoyable, much more beneficial to others by taking the thing that you're really good at. And it may not be designing buildings, but the skills that you've been trained to have as an architect can be used in other ways and become really, really successful yourself, as well as giving back to the world at large.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, traditionally, the international development sector has always shut the door on architects. It's only in recent years that they're opening the door to designers and understanding that this design thinking or systems thinking is really relevant to problem solving. It's always been, but you know, without those without that change in mindset, I think for the sector, it's been a little bit difficult for architects and designers to be a part of that conversation. Traditionally, it was logisticians, engineers, project managers, but now I think there's been a bit of a shift in that thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would love to leverage Entree Architect to do things like that, because we have a very large community now, and I think there's a lot of small firm architects that clearly have those same skills that are looking for ways to solve individual problems so they can do, just focus on one project and say, okay, I can fix that project, and then they fix that project, and they give them some guidance. And then they move on to, going back to designing a house that they've just finished designing. I think it'd be great to sort of take that, the idea of using the internet and using the connections that we can form on the internet to solve these problems, by using the skills of individuals throughout the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're getting close to the end here, but I want to talk about how you continue to do what you do, because you got started with a little bit of seed funding and some guidance, but now you're continuing, you're building these projects. How are these projects funded, and how do you continue to fund the projects that you're doing?
Yeah. Do you want to go for this?
Yeah. Well, it's a mix. I think we have talked quite a bit about how we diversify and build a bit of resilience through different funding streams. So we've some of our projects, the one in China in particular, is funded by a grant. We have individual donors, corporate donors. We're also doing some fee paying work and design work, particularly in London. I think just trying to think more strategically about how we communicate the value that we have for organizations that are supporting socially and economically deprived communities. So housing associations, which in the US, I guess, would be some kind of social landlord, local councils and government bodies, so them becoming more interested in the design process and design thinking. We can tap into that as well. What am I missing?
No, that's correct. For the last sort of 1 to 3 years, we've been very much a charitable model, focusing on those streams: corporates, grants, individual giving. Whereas increasingly we're starting to tap into income generating work, because we do really think we have value to add to projects. And we're trying to find a nice balance, a sweet spot between those two.
So when you're talking about grants and donations, that takes a lot of time, right? That's fundraising. And so I would imagine that's one of the major roadblocks for early charities. When you first start, you need to spend a lot of time raising money, and you don't, if it's just one or two of you, how do you break up that time? How much time are you spending on fundraising, and how much time are you spending on the actual work that you want to do?
I was having this conversation the other day. What is the right balance, especially when donors, a lot of donors expect you to be spending, 90% of your time working on projects. But I think we like to think that fundraising is part of what we do, because it's not simply just bringing in money. It's also sharing what we do and how we do it. Fundraising and our marketing are totally interlinked. And one of the things that we're set up to do, one of our charitable purposes, is to advocate and champion participatory design. So we like to think of it a little bit differently. We don't just have our begging bowl out to bring in funds so we can do our projects, but it's sort of a little bit more holistic than that. It's part of our outreach, really, part of our dissemination of these methods that we want to champion.
Mm.
And you're doing income generating work as well. So there's fee-based work that's happening as well that helps fund it. Is that correct? I heard you say that.
Yeah. I think particularly in London, I think you're starting to see organizations like local government teams are starting to see the value of understanding the needs of residents, understanding the needs of local service users, understand the needs of patients, and that being the basis for quality designs and services. And so there's definitely we definitely see a growing interest in the kind of human-centered process and participatory research, participatory design methods. So yeah, we are figuring out ways to better communicate that and why we think that it's intimately linked to quality services and quality spaces.
Yeah, I love that idea. When people come to me, students come to me with ideas that they want to do a nonprofit or a charity. That's always my recommendation is to build a business first. Go build a profitable business and then use the funds that come from that, a portion of those funds to start your venture. And then have this create some sort of continuous sustainable income generation that continuously helps fund it. It may not fund the entire thing, but it would help you with some continuous revenue. And when you go to donors, you can say, well, look, we're already donating X number of dollars from our own pockets to make this happen. It may make the fundraising part of things easier.
We see a lot of that sort of model in different organizations. An organization that has a for-profit arm and a non-profit arm. In some ways that makes things a little easier. In some ways it also has its own challenges that comes along with it, and because one sort of leads to the other and where are you committed to, et cetera,
right.
et cetera.
You're back to dividing your time again.
Yeah. But yeah, we have the burden but also the challenge, which can be a positive thing of having to fundraise as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. The work that you're doing, I love the story of how it got started, how you keep it going. What's the future? What are your plans for Azuqo in the next couple of years?
Well, we'd like to grow, I think, our core team, so that we can take on more projects, bigger projects, work with more communities, have more impact. We don't necessarily see ourselves as the next Oxfam with thousands of staff, but like a good core team, so we can really support the communities that we're set up to support.
So azuqo.org is the website, azuqo.org. Is there any place else that our listeners can go and see some of the work that you're doing?
Twitter.
So what's your Twitter handle?
Azuqo_org. And we also have a Facebook page. We're also on LinkedIn. Feel free to email or message Joe and I.
Yeah, please get in touch.
Yeah, we're always happy to chat and share and also listen and learn about what other people are working on and their interests and their hopes and their concerns.
So definitely, if anybody's interested in learning more about Azuqo, go to azuqo.org or check them out on Twitter or Facebook. reach out to them and thank them for sharing some of their stories here today and inspiring you. Before we wrap things up, Joe and Nathan, I'd love to ask you my final question that I ask all my guests. Let's start with you, Joe. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think give back, and I'm not entirely sure what that looks like, and I think it looks different for different practices, but give back, because the very act of giving, I think you gain so much. So whether that's, you know, taking on one pro bono project a year, whether that's partnering with a architectural nonprofit, but yeah, give back, share your services potentially for free. Yeah,
I think that's a great one. Sharing your knowledge is a theme of mine. Every time someone hears me, they will hear me say to share your knowledge. And so giving back is if you don't give services, to just share the knowledge that you have with someone else to help them get to the next step is a great suggestion. Nathan, what about you?
Yeah, I think just in line with Azuko, I think really try to engage with whoever that person is that you're designing for, and really try to listen and understand holistically what their needs are and what's meaningful to them. And I think being able to tell a bigger story about who this person is and what's important to them, I think is vital, not just for built solutions, but for solving big social issues, for creating businesses, et cetera, et cetera.
So Joe Ashbridge, Nathan Ardiz, thank you for the work that you're doing, first of all, for sharing your skills and your talents and your knowledge with the communities that you do. Thank you for being here and sharing your knowledge here at Entre Architect Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for your help, Mark, and thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah.
I just want to share one more thing here before we wrap up the show. If you'd like to get in touch with Joe Ashbridge or Nathan Ardiz over at Azuko, check them out at their email address. Their email is info@azuko.org. Go send them a note. Let them know that you heard them here at Entre Architect Podcast. Thank them for sharing their knowledge, and ask them any questions you might have about putting together a nonprofit or how you can help them succeed in what they're doing. info@azuko.org. And if you liked what we shared here today and find value in anything that we're doing here at Entre Architect, all I ask is one simple request: share this episode or any episodes with a friend. This episode is entrearchitect.com/episode194. Tick tock, tick tock. 200's coming up. entrearchitect.com/episode194. Share that link with a friend. And it's working. I know that you're sharing because I'm watching the stats on this show. And we have seen some massive growth over this past year since I've been asking you to share it with just one friend. If you've already shared it, go share it with one other friend, because it's working. And I thank you for sharing this podcast with your friends. entrearchitect.com/episode194 for this episode. And don't forget to go visit the website at entrearchitect.com/free course. Go right there, free course, and get your free profit course and learn how to build a profitable architecture firm for free. entrearchitect.com/free course. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to go build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, share what you know, share it with the world, share it today, every day. Love, learn, share what you know. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. Have a great week.